I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Republican head of the Senate Intelligence Committee is proposing the most sweeping overhaul of U.S. intelligence in half a century, including a breakup of the CIA. The proposal by Senator Pat Roberts would place most of the country's intelligence under a powerful national director with four deputies overseeing intelligence gathering, research, analysis, and military support. Brian Bender is covering the story for the Boston Globe. He joins us from Washington. Brian, can you further outline some of the changes?
Probably two of the biggest changes that Senator Roberts is calling for is taking the Directorate of Operations, as it's called, out of the CIA. That is the unit that does covert operations and gathers intelligence around the world. And it would also take three agencies, the National Security Agency, as well as two others that are currently under the Pentagon, and take them away from the Defense Department and put them as well under this new powerful national director.
Right. And what has been the response to that?
When Senator Roberts announced it yesterday, people were surprised because it goes further than the 9/11 Commission recommended. It goes further than the Bush administration has called for. And it really shakes up what has been the bureaucracy basically since 1947. And it's certainly going to meet with lots of opposition from the Defense Department, which doesn't want to give up power, from the CIA, which has a very long and storied history, certainly doesn't want to go away. You know, I think Republicans and Democrats are going to question whether or not this is too drastic at a time when the U.S. is still fighting and looking for Al-Qaeda, when there are still threats to the United States. Could the government afford such a huge reform?
And others will say, can it afford not to?
Well, exactly. I think families of the victims of September 11th certainly look at this as a very forceful move.
Well, as you point out, the bill summary goes out of its way to say, we are not abolishing the CIA. We are reordering and renaming its three major elements. Can you briefly tell us what those other elements are?
Well, we mentioned the Directorate of Operations, which would be removed from the CIA, but then there is the Directorate of Intelligence, which analyzes intelligence and information, and then there's a Science and Technology Directorate. And those other two pieces would also go underneath this new National Director of Intelligence. They would become independent agencies, if you will, in their own right. So when Senator Roberts says it's not abolishing the CIA, I think, as one senior intelligence official told me yesterday, that's a bit disingenuous because effectively that's what it does.
But in light of 9/11 reports, I'm wondering, this separation of, you know, the gathering of intelligence and the analysis of the intelligence, what does that point to?
A realization that before 9/11, the government's intelligence agencies were focused primarily on specific threats. And what they're trying to do here is say, well, instead of focusing on specific threats, let's take everything we have and split it up into capabilities. What can this agency do? This agency can collect intelligence. Let's put the analysts all together. Let's put the people that gather the intelligence all together. And by doing that, they effectively smash what was the structure before, which was organized more around the Pentagon gathering military intelligence, the CIA gathering counter-terrorist information. And I think there's going to be a lot of questions about whether or not you can really do that.
Any chance that the president is going to sign this bill into law?
There's always a chance of that, but even as Senator Roberts said, he views this proposal as a blueprint. So I don't think it will pass in its current form, but I do think certain elements of it are likely to be adopted.
Brian Bender covers intelligence for the Boston Globe. Brian, thanks.
Sure.
Well, both President Bush and John Kerry are taking a break from campaigning today, but you'd never know it, considering the hailstorm of charges and countercharges in new ads focused on John Kerry's war record in Vietnam. The Kerry campaign is battling accusations from other former veterans that the Massachusetts senator lied about killing an enemy soldier and exaggerated his wounds to win medals and leave Vietnam. Well, the Kerry campaign has responded with this ad.
Bush smeared John McCain 4 years ago. Now he's doing it to John Kerry. George Bush denounced the smear. Get back to the issues. America deserves better.
The Bush campaign is calling that ad libelous and wants television stations to, quote, set the record straight. And the group that launched the ad skirmish in the first place, Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, is now out with their own new ad, slamming Kerry for telling Congress in 1971 that vets had committed war crimes.
It demoralized us.
Crimes committed on a day-to-day basis.
He betrayed us in the past. How could we be loyal to him now?
Ravaged the countryside of South Vietnam.
He dishonored his country and, more importantly, the people he served with. He just sold them out.
Well, joining us on the line are Ann Kornblut, political correspondent for the Boston Globe. Hi, Ann.
Hi.
And Jeff Zeleny, political correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. Hi, Jeff.
Hi there.
Jeff, let's start with you. Your newspaper became a part of this story this weekend when one of your editors, who served with John Kerry, who had previously refused to talk about Kerry's war record, backed up John Kerry's version of events in Vietnam. What's been the response to that?
Well, the response has actually been quite interesting from readers who first saw the story. We're getting a lot of email, a lot of phone calls saying that the people are tired of this being an issue in the campaign. One email came in this morning from a soldier who's from Illinois who's serving in Iraq right now, and he said that, you know, of any voter, I should be interested in the war records of the candidates, but he said, you know, this is all politics, and he wishes the campaigns would get on to other issues. So, but there's no question that it is resonating with voters, and why this has become such a hot topic.
Well, and Dan, the Sunday Washington Post found another previously unheard from vet who also backs up at least part of John Kerry's story. His name is Wayne Langhofer. Your paper has been speaking to veterans all along as you cover the senator from Massachusetts. Do you think the campaigns are going to be able to get on to future business, or do they have to deal with this?
Well, I do think eventually they'll get on to future business. I mean, look, it's August. This is normally the dead zone. President Bush hasn't laid out his second-term agenda yet. The Republican convention hasn't happened yet. But in the meantime, I think there is a sense that people won't actually want to know what happened. And it's also a very visceral subject. It's interesting, and it really cuts to the core of who people are. And there's still a lot of raw, open nerves, open wounds and raw nerves from the Vietnam era that is part of what's keeping the story going.
Well, Jeff, again, in Chicago, the Bush campaign had to scramble this weekend. It was revealed that one of the Bush volunteers appears in the anti-Kerry ad. He was quickly removed from the Bush campaign, and the Bush campaign said they didn't know about it in advance. But what about this sense, and the Kerry campaign has filed a complaint with the Federal Election Commission, that the Bush campaign is backing the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth?
No one has yet drawn a direct link from the Swift Boat to Veterans for Truth to the Bush campaign. The underlying issue of all this is campaign finance reform, a bill signed into law 2 years ago by the president, was supposed to eliminate or at least reduce the role of money in politics. What it actually has done is created a confusing muddle, you know, that is really playing out in this campaign. Who is paying for these so-called independent expenditures? On the Republican side, you have some questions that certainly aren't clear. And on the Democratic side, there are murky lines that aren't clear as well. But I think I agree with Ann. The controversy of the war of 30 years ago is probably likely to die down. It will not become the main issue for the next 2 months of the campaign. But one thing that will become an issue is the spending by these so-called independent groups that will probably only increase for the next 71 days before the election. And it really speaks to the heart of what did campaign finance reform accomplish.
Well, back to the Swift Boat controversy, though. Ann Kornblut, do you think that President Bush will denounce the Swift Boat ads? He's been called on to do so by the Kerry campaign, and there's a thinking that he might speak today.
I would be surprised if he did. I think there's some political danger in the president coming out and denouncing this veterans group. Insofar as he's got a lot of support in the military right now, and it would be difficult for him to be seen attacking one of his own, essentially, another, the veterans groups that have been so strongly in his corner.
Well, isn't there a difficulty though in his not doing that?
Because that's the flip side. He's got a very difficult calculation to make here, and so on the one hand, I would be surprised if he did come out and condemn it. On the other hand, if he does not, this is not going to go away.
Jeff, one last question to you. You say that your readers want to move on. They want to hear about other issues besides this one, but it doesn't look like this one is going away. This weekend, we also saw former Kansas Senator Bob Dole come into the picture. He called on Kerry to apologize for his 1971 congressional testimony in which he accused U.S. soldiers of atrocities in Vietnam, which seems to be the new line this week. You know, last week was John Kerry's service in the war. This week we seem to be seeing criticism of his speaking after the war.
I think you're absolutely going to see you know, a continuation of that shift. And that's one thing that John Kerry is very concerned about and his strategists are concerned about. I think some veterans, you know, are more likely to be much more concerned about his speaking out against them and the war right after he returned from Vietnam than, you know, the nuts and bolts of the specific fights. But it also is not a problem-free issue for the Bush campaign because the president has still not answered all of the questions of where he was during this period. So, you know, I think it will remain an issue, but I would be surprised if it was the issue of the campaign.
Mm. Well, I want to thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ann Kornblutis, political correspondent for the Boston Globe. Jeff Zeleny, political correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. This note, in Iraq, U.S. forces are stepping up pressure on cleric Muqtada al-Sadr to hand over the Iman Ali Shrine in Najaf to religious authorities. There's been sporadic fighting reported in the city, but the standoff continues. Meanwhile, al-Sadr was reportedly instrumental in the handover of kidnapped American journalist Micah Garin. He was held for 9 days by Iraqi militants before his release yesterday. Garin says today he will stay in Iraq to complete his documentary on plundered Iraqi artifacts. Just ahead, will the blame go all the way to the top? Two reports are expected on prisoner abuse at Abu Ghraib. And later, learning how to care for a dying child. There's more coming up, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The military judge presiding over pretrial hearings in Germany in the Abu Ghraib prison scandal said today he will consider dismissing charges if prosecutors fail to speed up the pace of the investigation. Four of the accused military police officers in the scandal are scheduled to have hearings this week in Germany. Another hearing is underway in the U.S. And last May, one soldier pled guilty to participating in abuse and will serve a year prison time. Meanwhile, two reports on Abu Ghraib are expected this week. The first, an investigation chaired by former Defense Secretary James Schlesinger, is anticipated to address whether or not Pentagon officials set clear rules for interrogation in Iraq. The other, authored by Army Major General George Fay, examines the military unit responsible for the interrogation. Joining us on the line is Washington Post reporter Josh White. He's been covering the so-called Fay report. Josh, welcome.
Hi.
Well, I know you spoke to Army officials. Anything jumping out at you immediately? We've heard, you know, other reports in the past about Abu Ghraib. Is there something jumping out about this one?
The indication that we're getting at this point, and of course, we haven't seen the report itself, is essentially that there were failures within the military intelligence brigade that was working at the prison in particular. There were military intelligence soldiers involved in some of the abuses. I mean, we've seen photographs of that already. And from what we've been told, there will be elements of responsibility levied at higher-level commanders, but not in a criminal sense, more in a leadership failure sense. We've heard in particular that there are going to be some concerns relayed regarding basically oversight, that they weren't paying close enough attention.
Oh, I was going to ask, because you write that these were failures of leadership that could rise to the highest levels of the U.S. command in Iraq, and you mentioned what one of them might be, a failure of oversight. Any other failures? I mean, if you could be more specific.
There are indications that there were warning signs, there were signals that there were abuses going on, or at least problems at the prison. Really, a number of people over the past months have described the prison as very chaotic, as really having its own culture. And essentially what we're being told is that the report will indicate that there some of those signals did rise up into the command in Iraq, in Baghdad, and that some of those signs were simply ignored.
Well, is there any sense that any of those leadership failures will translate into criminal charges?
Well, at this point, what they're telling us is that so far only those soldiers who were directly involved in the abuses are going to face criminal charges, like the seven MPs that we've seen charged already. It's likely that others who appear in the photographs will be charged with some sort of, you know, military criminal activity. We've also been told that some of the contract workers who are at the prison may also be recommended for charges. Now, those charges would have to go through the Department of Justice, and there would have to be a decision-making process on that end.
These were civilian contractors. What kind of jobs were they doing?
At this point, you know, the indications are that it would be interrogators, intelligence analysts, linguists, that sort of thing.
Mm. Well, Josh, you're a longtime military correspondent for The Washington Post. Have you seen any changes in the military because of the reports that are coming up, the ones we've already heard?
Well, it's clear that they've been looking at policy. And I, from the very beginning, the issue of how to treat enemy prisoners of war, detainees that are captured after the war is over, the enemy combatants, I mean, all of that has been looked at very carefully. What the military is saying at this point is that some of those policies have already been changed, that there are more clear directions to those who are interrogating detainees and working with detainees. So I think the military is working to figure out, A, how this all occurred in the first place, and B, how to prevent it.
Well, and it's been reported that the Army Reserves, for one, is planning to change the way they train and recruit. We've all seen their previous ads selling the reserves as a way to make money or go to college. And now the new ads say honor is never off duty. And some would see that as a thinly veiled reference to Abu Ghraib.
Well, there were certainly issues. I mean, for example, in the Lindy England Article 32 hearing at Fort Bragg earlier this month, and it's slated to continue at some unspecified date in the future, there was testimony that essentially these MPs who were working very closely with the detainees who were working at Abu Ghraib simply were not trained for this mission. The people who were put in charge of really the most important wing of the prison where the military intelligence holds were kept were two people who had civilian experience in prisons. The rest of the unit, they weren't trained for this. They were trained for really convoy protection, force protection, traffic, that sort of thing. It's clear, I think, from all the reports that we've heard at this point, that there wasn't adequate training in advance for this.
Finally, Josh, do you get any sense, again, the reports come out tomorrow, but any sense that in addition to the failure of leadership on the part of the high command in Iraq, there might have been any direct orders to perform any of these acts of abuse?
Well, as of right now, none of the reports and none of the official accounts have indicated that there was any specific direct order to abuse anyone. And in fact, the highest levels of the command structure, going all the way up to General Sanchez, in many of their memos and directives to military intelligence, to military police, to all soldiers, were to treat detainees with respect and to respect their human dignity. The difficulty comes from the fact that we have not seen everything, and we don't know what verbal orders may or may not have been given. Some of the MPs and their defense attorneys claim that they were ordered to do these things. Mm. Now, were they ordered to do these specific acts, or were they ordered more generally to soften up the detainees? I mean, I think that's a key question that we hope will be answered, you know, in some of the coming reports, as well as in further discussion of the evidence and these further hearings.
And then there will be the debate, what does soften up mean?
Exactly,
definition of that. Josh White, thank you.
You're welcome.
Josh is a military correspondent for The Washington Post. And tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll talk to a physician who's called for an investigation into whether medical personnel aided or overlooked abuse at the Abu Ghraib prison. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. While the two major party candidates and their surrogates hammer it out over who did what in the war in Vietnam, there are other political parties trying to organize and field candidates for local, state, and federal offices. Today, Here and Now's Gail Harris checks in on libertarians.
George W. Bush could get nadered in 2004, according to political scientist Larry Jacobs at the Hubert Humphrey Institute of Public Policy. He explains that just a small number of independents and disaffected Republicans voting Libertarian this November could take votes from Bush in crucial swing states. Libertarians say they are not in the race to steal votes, and they don't expect to win. They're running to gain support for the Libertarian Party. And to learn more about the party and better understand the libertarian message, we're joined now by Michael Bednarik, the libertarian presidential candidate. Michael, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, first of all, here's a little about what we know of you. You're a computer consultant from Texas, expert in constitutional law, not exactly a conventional politician, and also from what we understand, a bit of a dark horse at the Libertarian National Convention in Atlanta last May.
That's true. I was struggling to even arrive in Atlanta to attend the convention. My two opponents, Gary Nolan and Aaron Russo, both had more name recognition and more financial support. However, libertarians are the party of principle, and after my participation in the debate, the delegates decided that I was best able to convey the libertarian message to non-libertarians.
So, in a few words, libertarians stand for, number one, lower taxes. Number two, what?
Bringing our troops home from Iraq, bringing our troops home from other countries around the world, preventing the draft, reducing the size of government to reduce the amount of cost to the taxpayer, and to return more of the decision-making process back to the state governments and to the individuals where it belongs.
Also for gay rights and against the war on drugs.
We are for individual rights. All individuals have rights. Gays are individuals, and therefore they have the same rights as everybody else. Libertarians are not in favor of our children taking drugs. However, the decades-old war on drugs has been a dismal failure. There are more drugs on the streets now than there were 50 years ago. And our agencies that police drugs are violating our rights, they are violating our property, and cause more of a threat to our liberties than the drugs themselves.
Well, Michael, a lot of people hearing this would say, well, that just sounds like common sense. So, you know, why is this a slow-growing movement?
because too many people have bought into the lie that, you know, you are wasting your vote to vote for a third party. The only wasted vote is when you cast your ballot for someone that you do not respect. The best way to send a message to Washington that you want lower taxes and you want less federal regulation is to vote Libertarian. That's the best way to let Washington know that you're unhappy with the status quo. We have a very unique political environment this year where the number of people who are disenchanted with the Democrats and Republicans is extremely high. People are looking for a politician that can be a leader, someone that has honesty, integrity, someone who knows the Constitution. And I think that the Libertarian Party is going to become an overnight success this November.
And what will you do to continue trying to get your message out?
We have produced television commercials that were already broadcast in New Mexico and had a very significant effect. We have had about $500,000 contributed, and we are hoping to raise $5 million so that my television commercials can be broadcast in all 50 states. Our problem is one of marketing. Most of the people in the United States have never heard of the Libertarian Party. As soon as they do, as soon as they understand what our platform is, they enthusiastically support our position. And so the only job that I really have is to let people in America know that they have another choice besides the lesser of two evils.
Michael, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Michael Badnarik is the Libertarian presidential candidate. Well, joining us now is Larry Jacobs, political scientist at the Hubert Humphrey Institute and an expert in third-party movements. Larry, welcome.
It's good to be with you.
Tell us, first of all, how does Michael Badnarik compare with past Libertarian candidates for president?
I would say he's similar in a lot of ways. They tend to be non-professional politicians. They kind of come out of the woodwork. They're not household names for the most part. But they're very earnest. They think of themselves as purists, and they've been around. Despite the fact they don't like organizations, they're very well organized, and they've been on all the states' ballots for presidential elections going back to 1980. So there's quite a track record there.
And who are the voters that the Libertarian message most appeals to?
You know, I think the best way to think of the Libertarian voter is to think of Barry Goldwater. They are people who really don't like government. And I'm not talking about your average garden variety Republican who's not fond of government. Libertarians would like to see, you know, executive branch departments eliminated, like the Department of Education and others. There's a kind of a consensus among Democrats and Republicans, and you see it with the No Child Left Behind Act, and you see it with the Medicare legislation, that both parties see a role for some form of big government. The Libertarians come in and say, no, we don't like that direction, and they really want to see the government reduced to the most minimal set of functions.
And you've been studying third parties for some time now, and from what I've read about your work, you really believe that third parties could make a huge difference this time, and not necessarily Ralph Nader as much as the Libertarians.
If you go back and you look at the 2002 election, you go around the country and there are a number of swing states like Oregon, Wisconsin, and Arizona, Missouri, with a Libertarian candidate in the 2002 elections, was the deciding factor, almost a deciding factor, in very close races. So in those states, the Libertarian may be able to draw, you know, 1 or 2, maybe 3% in a very close race and tilt the contest in favor of the Democrats.
So no doubt, as far as you're concerned, that it's Bush that the Libertarian candidates draw votes from?
The Libertarian candidates tend to draw from Republicans who tend to vote for the Republican candidate but are not the full loyalists. They've got questions in their mind. And so for a Republican who supported Ronald Reagan, supported Barry Goldwater, sees a very small role for government, the Libertarian could be an enticement.
Well, let's explore that a little bit, because if Nader is drawing votes from the Democrats and the Libertarian candidate is drawing votes from the Republicans, in some sense, do they just cancel each other out?
They might, though I think it's much more likely that Nader is going to be more damaging to the Democrats. The problem that the Libertarians have is no one's heard of Michael Badnarik. Nader's a household name, and name recognition is everything in politics. So the biggest challenge for the Libertarians is to get on voters' radar screen And so far, they have not been successful in doing that. And they need to be taken seriously in order for voters, more voters, to take them seriously. And that means getting a chance to talk. And as you can hear from Michael Badnarik, he's got a message.
Larry, thank you so much.
Good to be with you.
Larry Jacobs of the Hubert Humphrey Institute of Public Policy speaking with Here and Now's Gail Harris. For more information, visit our website, here-now.org. And still to come, healthcare workers get training in how to care for children who are facing death. You're listening to Here and Now. And now a check-in with the Olympics. Russia's gold medal-winning shot putter faces a lifetime ban from the sport after she became the first athlete of the Athens Olympics to be stripped of a title after testing positive for steroids. This just one day after a Greek weightlifter lost his bronze medal because of doping. And U.S. gymnast Paul Hamm's all-around gold medal remains in question because of a scoring dispute. Well, joining us on the line from Athens is John Powers of the Boston Globe. John, let's go to Hamm's dispute, first of all. For those who are, you know, trying to follow all of this, what is the dispute?
Well, the dispute actually has nothing to do with Paul Hamm, who won the gold medal all by himself with no scoring issue there. The question was the bronze medal finisher from Korea. The Koreans are claiming that on his parallel bars routine, the judges assigned him a lower start value than he was entitled to and therefore should have had a higher score, which would have given him the gold medal. The issue here is whether or not now the result should stand, which it usually does in gymnastics if you don't protest before the event is over, or whether there should be some kind of a duplicate gold medal awarded to rectify the error.
Well, how is this affecting Paul Hamm? Because, in fact, you know, if that other athlete had had that extra whatever it was, tenth of a point, he would have won the gold.
Well, except what the Americans say, and this appears to be true, is that what the judges also missed was a mistake by the Korean that should have cost him two-tenths of a point. So if the event were judged fairly, the Korean wouldn't have won a medal at all. But it seems as though that issue now has been overtaken by the politics of the issue, and it would not now surprise me if the Americans allow the Koreans to have a gold medal just to keep them from pushing this any further. Paul seems bewildered. I was talking to him last night. He can't understand what he might have done wrong and why the issue wasn't settled on the day, as it always has been in gymnastics.
Now, some of the agony of both victory and defeat yesterday in women's sports. To the marathon first, U.S. marathoner Deanie Castor won the bronze medal, and she sobbed when she realized that she did. But, oh, my gosh, the British runner collapsing on the track and quitting was just hard to watch.
Yeah, and I thought people thought that would happen. Paula Radcliffe is not known for being a heat runner, and that is a very hot course. I was up at rowing yesterday, which is up beyond the marathon, and even at 6 p.m., which is when the race started, it's like it is noonday sun most places in the U.S. Down south. I think she just ran out of gas, and I think you'll see that happening in the men's marathon, too.
All right. And then Gail Devers in the 100-meter hurdle event, the U.S. runner who, you know, it's just so captivated people, just pulled up short like a racehorse before the hurdle.
That's right. And what is funny here is that Gail Devers' favorite event and best event has been the hurdle. She has never won a medal at it at four Olympics. Her gold medals have come in the 100, which is kind of her fun event. But I think everyone thought that finally, if you run this race long enough, you should be able to get a gold medal. But again, that's why they have the games. It's all about performing on the day. But I think anyone who knows Gail well feels badly for her because, I mean, this was clearly her last shot.
Well, let's leave on a brighter note for at least U.S. athletes. A gold medal in rowing?
A gold medal in rowing for the men's eight, which has taken 40 years. They had never won it since 1964. And the U.S. women, who had not won a medal in the last 20 years, won a silver medal behind the Romanians. So it's the best day for U.S. rowing here. And the U.S. women's softball team just won the gold medal for the third straight time, beating Australia, and only gave up one run in the entire tournament. It's a very poignant story because the wife of the coach of the softball team died of a brain aneurysm just a couple of weeks before the game. So I think the team was dedicating the gold medal to her also.
Well, John, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
John Powers of the Boston Globe spoke to us on his cell phone from Athens. Stay with us. There's more ahead here. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This note, check your timesheet. New overtime rules, known as the Fair Play Rules, pushed by the Bush administration, go into effect today. Under the new regulations, for every hour worked above 40 hours in a single work week, employers are required to pay 1.5 times the regular pay rate. But there are exceptions. For instance, many workers, including those who earn more than $100,000 a year, will be exempt. The Labor Department says no more than 107,000 workers will lose overtime eligibility, and about 1.3 million will gain it. But the Economic Policy Institute in Washington disputes that, saying 6 million workers will lose benefits, and only a few will get new rights to extra pay. And critics point out that executives will be exempt from overtime, but the new rules redefine executive to include, say, manual workers who oversee 2 or 3 other workers. The Bush administration and business groups say the new rules are necessary because the old ones were out of date and confusing. The law comes after decades of lobbying by businesses, including Walmart, Starbucks, Radio Shack, and Bank of America. In recent years, the medical world has started to question how it deals with death and how doctors and nurses can help their terminally ill patients die with grace and with dignity. Many adults can now receive end-of-life care at home, but it's a different story for children. Each year in the United States, about 55,000 children die, most of them in a hospital, and some parents say their children die without proper end-of-life care. Now a new program in Newton, Massachusetts is underway to train healthcare providers to help children and their parents contend with looming death. WBUR's Rachel Gottbaum listened in on a role-playing session.
Mr. and Mrs. O'Brien.
Hi.
I'm Dr. Jane Glewett. This isn't an easy conversation to have. A week ago, Bill and Lisa O'Brien's 5-year-old son, Billy, was in a drowning accident. He has been in the hospital's ICU ever since. Dr. Jane Gluer tells Billy's parents that their son is brain dead and can no longer breathe on his own.
If we decide together that you want Billy's respiration supported and want him to go up to the ward, he would require a tracheostomy tube, a tube put in through his neck that would he would then be attached to a ventilator that would help him breathe. And that's at one end of the spectrum.
Dr. Gluer tells the O'Briens they will eventually have to decide whether to keep their son on life support in a vegetative state or let him die.
If we were to take the breathing tube out, I anticipate that he would likely die within a few hours. And you would... I'm sorry.
In this case, the parents, Bill and Lisa O'Brien, are actors. But the doctor is real, and the audience consists of healthcare professionals and parents who have found themselves in the same situation in their own lives. After the performance, there are tears and laughter, and the facilitator opens the floor to get reactions.
You allowed them the time and the space to cry as they needed or just to connect with each other without rushing the conversation forward.
This 3-day training was held recently in Marlborough by the Initiative for Pediatric Palliative Care. The program is spearheaded by the Education Development Center in Newton. And the idea is to teach doctors, nurses, social workers, and chaplains from around the country how to communicate with parents and better care for their children with life-threatening illness.
In general, we don't want to believe that children die.
David Browning is director of the initiative.
The kind of emphasis on technical training for physicians and on really becoming experts at the latest knowledge that will bring technological cures to children, we've done a really, really good job at that. The interpersonal skills that are required to connect in authentic ways with family members that are going through some of the most difficult times in their lives have not been part of their training. So that's what's been missing.
Browning says how doctors deliver bad news to a parent can have a lasting effect on a family that is already suffering. Parents who have lost a child are also educators in the training. They all work with hospitals in their region, like Michelle Metcalf, who came to the workshop from Seattle. Her daughter was diagnosed with liver cancer at the age of 15. She says it was like a bomb being dropped.
The transplant surgeon walked in the room, did not sit down, stood there and said, I've reviewed your scans. I'm very sorry. There's nothing I can do. I wish you the best of luck, and walked out. Followed by an adult oncologist who came in, sat down, was wringing his hands, had difficulty making eye contact with us, and said, this is a very serious case. Your daughter's disease is advanced. There's very little we can do to help her. Why don't you decide to take her on a vacation, go to Disneyland, and in a few weeks, if you decide you want treatment, why don't you get back in touch with me? And he walked out. And it took my daughter 2 months to get out of the damage that those few moments did with those two physicians.
Palliative or end-of-life care is different for children than adults. Hospice care for children is not generally covered by insurance because it is much more difficult to determine whether a child is in the last months of life. Children may also not be able to communicate how much pain they are in, and their parents play a pivotal role in treatment decisions. In 2002, the Institute of Medicine released a report criticizing the U.S. healthcare system for lacking compassionate and competent care for children facing death. Last year, in response to the IOM report, the Initiative for Pediatric Palliative Care was formed. Meg Comeau also attended the recent training. When her daughter Sarah was an infant, she was diagnosed with Prader-Willi syndrome, a rare genetic disorder.
When Sarah was diagnosed, we were told in about a 20-minute office visit that she would never go to college, never live independently, never have children of her own. So all of our dreams for our only child were pretty much destroyed during that time.
But Comeau says how her doctor handled the situation made all the difference.
The physician, as I remember, got up from behind his desk, came over and sat down next to me. He pulled a book down off of his bookshelf and started showing me pictures of kids with Prader-Willi syndrome. He started to talk to me a little bit about what she would be able to do, not only what she wouldn't be able to do. I remember at one point he sort of leaned over and put his hand on my arm to comfort me a little bit. And just the way he did that made such a huge difference. It's really lasted with me. It's really stuck with me.
Much of the focus of the Initiative for Pediatric Palliative Care is on creating a more empathetic relationship between the provider and patients and their families, an area where doctors get little training. Carl Robinson is a pediatrician who came to the training from New Orleans.
We were not trained in how to talk to parents. We were not trained in how to react to parents. We were not trained in how to react to the stress of life and death situations.
But Robinson says he has already learned more about communicating with families by listening and talking to parents and providers here, and he will take what he has learned back to his practice in Louisiana. There are more than 24 pediatric palliative care teams in hospitals in the U.S., and more are being created. They include care into the bereavement period. Most parents say that is what is lacking, that once their child dies, the contact between the healthcare provider ends abruptly, and they feel abandoned when they are most vulnerable. Salvatore Avila says that is why he became a parent educator. His daughter was diagnosed with congenital brain damage. When he and his wife finally decided there was nothing more they could do for her, they took their daughter off life support and let her die. At that time, he says, they were shunted aside.
It was noticeable how the medical team lost interest in our case the minute we decided to let her die.
Avila says the problem is that most doctors view death as an enemy to beat instead of a final step that is natural and inevitable.
I would tell them, and I often do, that death is not the enemy. Death is just a process that every one of us is going to go through. So why don't we try to refocus and help people die with dignity, in a smooth way, with hope, with human touch? And not only the family, the caregivers, the touch, being there, I care for you.
And that's what the Initiative for Pediatric Palliative Care is trying to achieve. The training has been established in 7 hospitals nationwide, including Dana-Farber and Children's Hospital in Boston. And the hope is that these doctors, social workers, chaplains, and parents will train their co-workers in hospitals around the country to bring compassionate care to children and their families facing death.
WBUR's Rachel Gottbaum. For more on palliative care for kids, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Ian Hughes. Our web producer is Zach Christo. Our newscast producer is Jeremy Hobson. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.